Earlier this evening, you were introduced to Dean Jerry. So I'm Judge Jerry, and I make a lot less money than Judge Judy. It's only fair for me to warn our participants that I run a meeting the same way Daryl Issa does. Our discussion this evening is on government secrets and leaks. Recent leaks of classified information have undermined the public's confidence in the ability of their government to keep secrets. Some have alleged that these leaks have caused irreparable harm to national security. All experts seem to agree that some exposures undermine America's ability to combat terrorism and security threats, but other leaks are viewed as a form of whistleblowing and public accountability. Are there good leaks and bad leaks, and who decides? Should the government do a better job of protecting secrets, and should leakers be prosecuted? We have an excellent set of debaters tonight, and actually they've had their own internal debate about whether this will be a debate or an open discussion, but I suspect they'll find enough to disagree about that it'll be most interesting. We have Roger Pilon of the Cato Institute, Vice President for Legal Affairs and Director of the Center for Constitutional Studies, and Professor Nadine Strossen of the New York Law School and former president of the ACLU. We are blessed to have these two here tonight. They have contributed generously to public debate at Federalist Society events and elsewhere, and contribute with intellectual honesty and generosity. I was just sharing thoughts with Nadine a few days ago about, I remember fondly, her participation more than 20 years ago at the Federalist Student Symposium at Yale, which maybe reflects on how old both of us are, Nadine.
We were both students then, weren't we?
Sure. So they've divided up their time, and I won't need to do much here as a traffic cop, and we'll begin with Roger Pilon.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Judge Smith. It's a real pleasure to be here. And after that last panel droned off on in their 10-minute sessions each, you'll be happy to know that both of us have prepared marks which are roughly 15 minutes each, so you'll be able to weigh in with your questions. Now, at the outset of this debate, I need to make it clear, for reasons that are going to be apparent shortly, that I'm speaking here for myself, not for the Cato Institute. So those of you who may be card-carrying libertarians out there who are expecting a full-throated libertarian critique of government secrecy will be disappointed. But in my defense, I pose to you no less a libertarian than Rand Paul, who wrote in the Wall Street Journal 2 months ago that too many people on both sides of the issue before us here this evening are, and I quote, trying to make a very gray subject black and white, a problem that too many young libertarians who have strayed too far from their classical liberal roots are guilty of, but I digress. I also want to point out in our preliminary discussions in the run-up to the evening's debate, my good friend Nadine expressed a strong preference for a discussion rather than a debate about our subject. I agree the subject is, as Senator Paul said, very gray, so this will be more of a discussion, though as we go along it may turn into a debate. We'll see. I'm going to first in this discussion, because on balance, I'm basically on the affirmative side of the question before us, namely, should we better protect government secrets and punish leaks more severely? Actually, those are two questions covering a very large set of issues, and neither Nadine nor I will be able to more than touch upon them. But let me start with the first question, whether we should better protect government secrets. To answer that, one could do worse than to start with first principles. The Declaration tells us that we leave the state of nature and create government to better protect our rights, which we do by creating government, public institutions that at least on the domestic side, better define our rights and better secure them through either regulatory risk reduction or ex post adjudication and prosecution. But while that resulted eventually in the American experience to a more perfect union and to a sense of nationhood, on the foreign side of things regarding other nations, we're still in a state of nature, as Locke noted, which means that public institutions we've created have to protect our rights, their main function, through rather different means, not mainly through ex post adjudication and prosecution, but preemptively through diplomacy, treaties, and if necessary, through force up to and including war. And all that requires intelligence and secrecy. But that secrecy troubles many small d Democrats, concerned as they often are about government transparency and individual privacy. And so we come to our first dilemma. If government is going to protect our rights, it's got to have the means to do so. But at the same time, those means themselves have to respect our rights, at least as far as possible. And there's the problem, and it's twofold. First, although secrecy is essential if government is to protect us from foreign threats, secrecy also frustrates the transparency that's necessary for citizens to exercise their democratic rights of self-government. And second, the gathering of intelligence may compromise our right to be left alone by our own government. Benjamin Franklin may have said, and I quote, "They who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." But when it came to practice, an older and wiser Franklin, heading up the Committee of Secret Correspondence at the nation's birth, kept the committee's actions secret even from the Continental Congress for fear of leaks. In the real world, in short, trade-offs are inescapable, and our history shows that's ever been so. By and large, by constitutional design and by experience, it's fallen mainly to the executive branch to conduct our foreign affairs, to gather the intelligence necessary to that end, and to protect that intelligence. Yet administrations have failed in all three of those duties, including the last, the issue before us this evening. To take the two most recent examples, it's appalling that such low-level personnel as Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden were not better vetted before they were given access to classified information, and that they were able to gain access to so much information. Clearly, the systems in place to guard against that failed. So to answer their first question, it's obvious. Yes, we should better protect government secrets. And let me digress from my prepared remarks here. I served in the Reagan administration in the Office of Personnel Management and in State and in Justice, in which I had high-level clearance in all agencies. When I was at OPM, I oversaw at one point the security clearances interviews or the people who performed those interviews for government officials. And I must say, it was shocking to me how ill-equipped these people were to ask the kind of questions that needed to be asked to learn more about the people. It is a classic example of government taking on a responsibility and not Congress not providing the wherewithal to get the kind of quality people that are necessary to conduct these vetting processes. But the second question before us is harder, because even if we did punish leaks more severely, it wouldn't go to the heart of the problem. In his recent book from Princeton, Secrecy and Leaks, Professor Raoul Saigar discusses in great detail the dilemma that secrecy poses. On one hand, it's essential for the conduct of foreign affairs, but on the other hand, secrecy is a shield behind which much abuse and lawlessness can occur, as our history amply demonstrates, for which leaks are often our only protection. Saigar argues that the framers thought the separation of powers would address the problem, but they left unaddressed the means by which that principle would be given effect in the context of state secrets. He notes that the issue was less pressing in the 19th century because we were less involved in foreign affairs, But that changed in the 20th century, even though our intelligence operations were still quite limited as late as the onset of the Second World War. With that war, however, followed by the Cold War, full-blown intelligence operations became essential, and with them, the potential for abuse grew. From the U-2 incident to the Vietnam War, the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations were each caught deceiving the American people. That led in the 1970s to greater congressional involvement in foreign affairs, the War Powers Resolution of 1973, the Freedom of Information Act amendments of 1974, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, and more. And with Congress more involved, the courts were brought in as well, adjudicating cases brought under those statutes. Yet abuses and leaks persist and will continue to, and for good reason. There is no ultimate solution to the problem secrecy poses. Congressional oversight is sometimes useful, but as we've seen in recent years, it's too often affords an opportunity for little more than after-the-fact posturing. Nancy Pelosi liked enhanced interrogation until it became public. Jay Rockefeller wrote a letter to Vice President Cheney protesting warrantless wiretapping, then put it in his drawer until the story broke years later. And more recently, Jim Sensenbrenger was appalled to learn about NSA surveillance, but he skipped the briefings he was offered on the practice. And if Congress is too often asleep at the switch, the Supreme Court, for its part, has been asked to rule on matters about which it has little or no expertise, producing opinions that give unclear guidance to courts that are then asked to wade in on these matters. But when we try to regulate by statute what for most of our history was done by the executive branch alone, such as the collection of foreign intelligence, we find that 535 generals up on Capitol Hill doing what they end up having to do again, over and over, as the world moves from analog to digital and far beyond, while they struggle to make sense of it all. Far better it is, as Judge Larry Silberman implied in his opinion in the 2002 In Re Sealed case for the FISA Appeals Court, to read the Constitution as having left that power as implicit in the executive power that is vested in the president. The hard truth to bear, of course, especially for lawyers, is that in the end, these foreign affairs issues are mostly political, not legal. It's no accident that the Constitution treats domestic lawmaking in some detail, while its treatment of foreign affairs is sparse by comparison. For the protection of the community against foreign attacks, Hamilton wrote in Federalist 70, it's essential that a unitary executive be characterized by decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch. Those are not the characteristics of the slow legislative process, much less of the even slower judicial processes. And so I conclude on the question whether the Mannings and Snowdens of the world, useful as their leaks may or may not be, should be prosecuted. That too is a political question, but one with real consequences going forward. Let me just say this. I was not unhappy to see that Rand Paul, however grudgingly, said that Snowden was no hero and that he should be prosecuted, proving that not every libertarian is disconnected from the real world. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you. My students are well trained to do that. I'm delighted to speak at this important event, having fond memories of speaking at many past Federalist Society student symposia, as Judge Smith acknowledged. Whenever I address a Federalist Society audience, I like to remind you of your very first founding principle. Roger talks about first principles. He's talking about the Constitution. I'm talking about first principles of the Federalist Society. And your very first founding principle could have come straight from the ACLU policy guide. I'm sure you all know it by heart. It is that the state exists to preserve freedom. Likewise, your mission statement stresses that The Federalist Society seeks to reorder priorities within the legal system to place a premium on individual liberties. Exactly 20 years ago, I was on a Federalist Society panel with one of your founding gurus, Irving Kristol, and as usual, I started by reciting these libertarian tenets of your group, and that set him into a state of shock, quite literally. Our discussion was published, so I'm going to read to you his exact response. Quote, "I am shocked to discover that the Federalist Society seems to have said somewhere that the state exists to preserve freedom. The Federalist Society should call a meeting immediately and change that." You say that, and you get yourself into the kind of trap that Ms. Strassen has now sprung. So, since then, before every Federalist Society speaking engagement, I reread your website to make sure you have not heeded Irving Kristol's advice. So far, you haven't done that. So to quote him, you're trapped by your own words when it comes to tonight's debate topic. The urgent need to reduce government secrecy and increase protection for whistleblowers follows directly from the parts of your mission statement that I just quoted. Moreover, my correct position in this debate is reinforced by yet another tenet in your mission statement, that the separation of government powers is central to our Constitution. Now, in contrast, the affirmative position, and I'm not going to say Roger's position, because I think, Roger, a lot of what you said is very gray, and I applaud that. In contrast, the affirmative position on the motion squarely violates the separation of powers and individual liberty that are enshrined in both the U.S. Constitution and the Federalist Society mission statement. Indeed, the same is true of the status quo on these issues. It already violates freedom and separation of powers. So for the motion to advocate change is in the exact opposite direction of where we should be going. We already have excessive executive branch secrecy, too often wielded not to protect genuine national security secrets, but rather to shield the executive from embarrassment, criticism, and dissent. Likewise, the status quo embodies selective, overzealous executive branch persecution of whistleblowers who have disclosed executive lawbreaking and power abuses, while other leaks, which aim to make the executive look good, go unpunished. Equally unpunished are the executive officials on whom the whistle is blown, who have violated the Constitution, violated federal statutes, and trampled on both individual freedom and separation of powers. All of this would be deplored by the founding father who is so revered by the Federalist Society that his profile is on your tie. Now, as a civil libertarian, I, of course, greatly admire James Madison, along with all of you. So long ago, I bought one of your ties for my husband, and I told him that all of those FSs on the tie stand for free speech. Let me remind you of one of the most famous, oft-quoted statements that James Madison made, which fully supports my position in this debate. And I'm sure you've all heard it, but it bears rethinking about in this context. He said, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. A people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives." So, as Irving Kristol warned you, to prevail tonight, I need only invoke your own founding principles and your own favorite founding father. Now, as it is a Friday night, and it is customary, I think, on some of these occasions to inject a little levity, before I elaborate on the reasons for my conclusion, I want to tell you a light story as a New Yorker who is delighted to be here in Florida. So it's one of my favorite stories that involves both of our states and two others. It involves four women who are driving across the U.S., one each from these four states, and some of you may hail from these, Florida, New York, Idaho, and Nebraska. Shortly after the trip begins, the woman from Idaho starts pulling potatoes from her bag and throwing them out the window. When the others ask her why she's doing that, she says, "We have so many of these darn things in Idaho, I'm just sick of looking at them." A moment later, the woman from Nebraska starts pulling ears of corn from her bag and tossing them out the window. When the others ask her why she's doing that, she says, "We have so many of these darn things in Nebraska, I'm just sick of looking at them." Inspired by these two other passengers, the Florida woman opens the car door and tosses out the New Yorker. Now, let me state a few factual premises on which I hope we will all agree as they reflect the consensus of experts, including from the intelligence community. I'd be very interested if you disagree with any of these, Roger. First, our classification system is dysfunctional, hugely bloated, covering material that poses no real security risks. Second, and relatedly, our system is therefore flooded with leaks as an inevitable counter to this excessive secrecy and essential for government accountability to we, the people, the ultimate governors. Third, excessive secrecy is a huge waste of our precious security resources. All of you fiscal conservatives out there, I'm sure there are a few of you in this crowd, should balk at the huge amount of counterproductive, the huge cost of the counterproductive classification or overclassification system, costing almost $11 billion in 2012, and that doesn't even include the massive expenses incurred by the security agencies because, ironically, those numbers are classified. Fourth, excessive secrecy actually undermines national security by preventing effective information sharing, thus leading to flawed intelligence. That point was underscored by none other than a former head of the whole classification system, J. William Leonard. As he said, government secrecy just about guarantees the absence of an optimal decision on the part of our nation's leaders, often with tragic consequences for our nation. Indeed, the bipartisan 9/11 Commission actually concluded that excessive secrecy could well have contributed to the 9/11 attacks. Also, given the Federalist Society's commitment to empowering state and local governments, I should stress that these governments complain about undue secrecy, that it has hampered their ability to fight terrorism, thus endangering all of us. For example, I'll quote Commander Michael Dowling of the LAPD Counterterrorism Bureau. He said, "The federal government's overclassification has been a substantial roadblock to local law enforcement's ability to play a significant role in stopping terrorism." Fifth, there are good leaks and bad leaks. I don't know of any responsible analyst who takes an all-or-nothing position on these issues, including my ACLU colleagues who have been working full-time on them. Rather, they advocate certain governing principles for handling particular cases. For example, I'd like to cite Ben Wisner, the ACLU lawyer who has been advising Edward Snowden. Ben has advocated four principles to shape fairer policies toward unauthorized disclosures, in contrast to what journalists have denounced as the Obama administration's war on not only whistleblowers, but also news gathering. So to substantiate those charges, I'll just cite two examples which should have special resonance for this crowd because they involve Fox TV and the Wall Street Journal. Last spring, we learned that in a leak inquiry, the Justice Department had secretly seized telephone and email records, including personal email records, of Fox News chief Washington correspondent James Rosen. Most chillingly, the FBI declared that there is probable cause to believe that Rosen had violated the 1917 Espionage Act, That archaic law, as its name indicates, was aimed at spies who transmit U.S. secrets to hostile countries. Throughout its history, countless journalists have issued countless stories based on countless leaks. Yet appropriately, not a single administration has prosecuted a single journalist under the Espionage Act. So the Obama administration's threat to do so against Fox's Rosen has cast a big chill over journalism. In the same vein, shockingly, the Obama administration has pursued more Espionage Act prosecutions against government employees who share information with the press than all prior administrations combined, going all the way back to 1917, more than three times the number. No wonder these attacks on basic news gathering have been deplored by journalists across the ideological spectrum. One example includes such a strong supporter of strong executive power and strong national security policies as the Wall Street Journal. It condemned the administration's what it called pattern of anti-media behavior, and it said that the administration's so-called leak investigations are less about deterring leakers and more about intimidating the press. That's the Wall Street Journal. So, how do we fairly accommodate both the government's legitimate interest in protecting some secrets and the public's vital need to know enough to ensure the government's accountability? Again, Roger and I agree that there is some balancing that has to be done here. Here are the four principles that Ben Wisner endorsed. One, government employees who expose misconduct should not be punished more severely than those who engage in the misconduct. Number two, the government should have to demonstrate that the leaked information had been properly withheld from the public. Number three, the government should not systematically fail to pursue leaks that advance its interests while aggressively prosecuting leaks that do the opposite. And fourth, whistleblowing leaks should be treated differently from other leaks. Especially given the government's excessive secrecy, we the people have to depend on whistleblowers to disclose a whole range. We've had to depend on them to disclose a whole range of post-9/11 power abuses, including the Abu Ghraib scandal, the CIA's secret prisons, kidnapping and torture of suspects, targeted killing of U.S. citizens by drone, and of course, the NSA's sweeping domestic dragnet surveillance, which has been repudiated across the political spectrum, including by many in this audience. Whistleblowers who disclose such government misconduct should be able to defend themselves on the ground that the public benefit of their disclosures far outweighs any harm to security. Now, to complement the core guidelines that Ben laid out, I'd like to just list a couple more points, which I would be happy to explain further during Q&A. First, we must drastically reduce the entrenched overclassification that has too long been prevalent. Second, we must provide clear procedures under which intelligence employees can report wrongdoing and be protected from retaliation. We currently lack such procedures. Therefore, individuals such as Edward Snowden have to risk their freedom and their careers by disclosing official misconduct to the press. Now, I assume that not everyone in this audience views Snowden as a whistleblowing hero, so I'd like to cite a pertinent editorial cartoon. It shows an angry, a furious NSA spy pounding his fist and exclaiming, "Snowden secretly stole private information," using the excuse that he was protecting the American people. Who does that traitor think he is? Us? my third point, government employees who disclose information to the press or public should not be criminally prosecuted unless they specifically intended to harm our national security interests and they had a substantial basis to believe that the public interest in disclosure outweighed any national security harms. Finally, members of the media should not be subject to criminal prosecution just for publishing information that they got from a government source who was unauthorized to provide it. That position has been endorsed by not only the Supreme Court, but also a federal judge who has been a Federalist Society stalwart, namely Fourth Circuit Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson. In fact, Judge Wilkinson's often quoted opinion on this point included an eloquent summary of the reasons why my position on tonight's motion is correct, so I'm going to conclude by quoting Judge Wilkinson. He said, "Criminal restraints on the disclosure of information threaten the press's ability to scrutinize and report on government activity. The First Amendment interest in informed popular debate does not simply vanish at the invocation of the words national security. National security is public security, not government security from informed criticism." Thank you.
I said I would, but not until
okay. You.
I'll give you something to work with. First of all, I agree with most of what Nadine said, but so I'm struggling to find those few points on which we disagree. I think this last point that she made is where I'll begin. This idea of self-appointed whistleblowers is deeply troubling in a system in which we have rules for what is to be classified and how that classified material is to be handled. If every official in government takes it upon himself to supersede those rules, then chaos results. Now, of course, most people don't, but enough do so that we have the problem that we have before us. And I give you no one more indicative of that problem than Snowden himself, who took it upon himself to say that the programs of the NSA were either illegal or unconstitutional in the face of Congress having approved of those programs in several iterations on one hand, and on the other hand, no final court ever having found them to be unconstitutional. Yet he presumes to rule otherwise with the benefit of credentials that would allow him to do so, or authority under the oath he took to do so. And so the great problem that arises with whistleblowers or others who take it upon themselves to go beyond the rules is that it's essentially a rejection of the system in which they work. And I would add to that that we have some historic figures like Martin Luther King and others who stayed and faced the music after they engaged in civil disobedience. They did not flee to China and then to Russia, about which I need not say much more after the events of the last couple of weeks. Now, I quite agree with Nadine that far too much is classified. I recall writing memos myself in the State Department and having a secret or top secret label put upon them, and I said, "This is nothing more than something I would send to this is a speech I'm going to give. Why does it need to be classified? I mean, I swear they classified who gets the parking spaces in the State Department." I mean, it was really amazing to see this. So there's no question that there is excessive secrecy, and a fair measure of it, is, as Nadine said, designed to protect officials from embarrassment from their own incompetence, of which there is no shortage in the government. Nadine spoke about Obama having gone after James Rosen at Fox. That doesn't really surprise anybody who watches Fox. But she also added that Obama's aim was to intimidate the press.
No, that was the Wall Street Journal.
That was the Wall Street Journal. Oh, that was not your view.
I share it.
Okay, then it was your view.
But I quoted him. I wasn't speaking for myself.
I'm shocked that Obama would undertake anything like that. All right, that's about enough. That's enough for 5 minutes, because again, we're having less of a debate than a discussion. Because, as I said, you read that Raul Sagar book. It's a very detailed and complex discussion, and one of the best that's come out in a long time. And you realize how complicated this issue is. And one of his points is that there are times when leaks are the only thing that will enable us to get to the bottom of government mischief, and we have to grant that is indeed the case, and so it becomes a political question whether you prosecute those leakers, but the history that he goes into of the last 200 plus years is one in which Congress repeatedly has refrained from absolving leakers of the sanctions that go with the violation of the oath that they take. And I think that is the right result, because it preserves the rule of law while it allows for an exclusion on the grounds of prosecutorial discretion, as the case may warrant it.
You're talking about the oath to, or affirmation to uphold the Constitution.
Every government official takes an oath,
right.
And entailed in that
or affirmation.
Are all the rules relating to secrecy and to the handling of classified materials.
Well,
every government official goes through, before he even is given any authority, the rules for handling classified material.
I was talking about the oath or affirmation to uphold the Constitution.
But I'm talking about the rules that are entailed
right.
As part of the law that is passed pursuant to the Constitution. It's all derivative, you see.
Now it's my turn.
It's a deductible system.
So
deductive system.
I agree with Roger that we cannot allow every individual to decide which rules to violate. That would be absolute chaos. On the other hand, we cannot allow any government official to ignore with impunity the fundamental rules. Roger, I'm sorry, I've got the ACLU edition today. I know. This one is thinner, so it's my traveling version.
But this one has my
preface.
Because
it's
got his
essay in it, that's why. But it's great. It's great. I recommend it. If you haven't read it, I assign it to my students. The conclusion, I didn't read the whole book. I just read a review of this Princeton book, and it's interesting. He argues that disclosure of secrets is morally justified when, one, based on clear and convincing evidence of abuse of public authority, two, does not pose a disproportionate threat to public safety, three, is as limited in scope as possible. And he comments that the two principal alternative candidates for implementing oversight, the courts and Congress, are unlikely to do so effectively. David Cole, in writing a review essay about the book, was sympathetic to the point that we both agree with, that we don't necessarily want to trust every person who leaks or discloses without authorization. As David says, no one elected them to act as our conscience, but if they didn't act, who would? We've seen how the FISA court, to some extent, has acted as a rubber stamp. Even to the extent it didn't, it was ineffectual, as a couple of the judges we now know, thanks to the post-Snowden declassification of opinions, have complained that from the get-go, the NSA was not telling the truth about the scope and nature of its surveillance and was not adhering to the conditions that the court put down, but the court is not able to enforce those restrictions. Congress, as Roger indicated, I'd like to quote somebody that I was on a Federalist Society panel with many years ago, William Safire, a revered conservative, longtime columnist for the New York Times, said, what Congress engages in should be called undersight, not oversight, but worse yet, it's political posturing. So when even folks that I admire, such as Wyden and Udall, when they asked questions to which we got least untruthful responses from the intelligence community, Wyden and Udall knew that those were lies, but they were not, they felt they weren't at liberty to tell us, the American people, about it. So if not the Snowdens of this world, where would we be? It's not a perfect system, but so I think getting this information is absolutely vital. In terms of going through appropriate channels, there were four NSA former employees who were extremely troubled by what they saw as violations of federal statutes and the U.S. Constitution, who did complain within the specified channels. By the way, there is far less, if any, meaningful protection for national security whistleblowers than for other whistleblowers. They went to the Inspector General, both the Defense Department and the NSA. They went to congressional committees. They used inside channels, and they were pilloried. One example that's gotten quite a bit of publicity is Thomas Drake. After 4 years of making his life what the judge, the federal judge, not a FISA court judge, but a real district court judge, said that the government had put him and his family through hell for 4 years, and it turned out that he hadn't even disclosed any classified information. Everything that he disclosed was already on the public record, and yet his life was made miserable. You are not protected against retaliation of the grossest kind. Now, we may disagree about the facts, but I think we can agree in principle, and this is one of the points that was made by the review commission that just recently reported to the president, there has to be meaningful protection for whistleblowers and independent review. Right now, the review is within their own agencies, and real protection against retaliation. We deserve that, and they deserve that. Finally, in terms of prosecution or not, clemency or not, I don't think anybody is saying that Snowden is immunized or should have some automatic defense on the basis of being a whistleblower, but rather that some clemency and forbearance should be exercised, as has been exercised in so many other contexts. President Obama, after all, was the one who said we have to look forward, not backward, in deciding not to prosecute those who had engaged in massive, gross violations of human rights and international law and domestic law. And even Rand Paul, since Roger quoted him, said that there would be some penalty for Snowden, quote, a few years in prison, but not the 35 years or life penalty that the Justice Department is apparently seeking.
I'll respond during the Q&A.
All right, do we have any questions for our panelists? Nobody thought of good questions, so let me just start with one for both of you, and that is, do you have any reflections on the issue of even if whistleblowers aren't to be prosecuted, about whether it makes a difference that what they're doing is profiteering, essentially, whether it's to write a book or be paid to go on talk shows or whatever it might be? What about that element of it? It's rather than some pure motive about that this needs to be disclosed, so I'm going to take a risk and disclose it.
Well, it seems to me that would only exacerbate the situation, because then we're talking about spies who leak secrets for money. That's the standard modus operandi for a spy. Mm-hmm. But here we're talking about essentially the same thing: a person who releases classified material and then uses it to catapult himself into the talking circuit and to the book circuit. I would just add one point here, Judge Smith, with respect to Snowden. I'm not as easygoing on him as Nadine would seem to be, because it turns out that it wasn't just the NSA business that he leaked materials about. The Wall Street Journal had a piece back on January 10 relating to the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency has released a report saying that he copied 1.7 million intelligence files. Most of the focus has been on the NSA issue, but in fact, most of the stolen documents concerned, the report said, and potentially compromise ongoing military operations. They exposed U.S. tactics and harmed relations with allies. The bulk of the documents pertain to Pentagon operations against terrorists, cyber criminals, and the like. So it's not just NSA that we're talking about here. When you've got 1.7 million intelligence files, you've got a lot, and we don't know yet even a small fraction.
Let's let Nadine respond quickly, and then we can get to our
just
questions.
Just very briefly, Roger, you're too credulous. Your colleague Julian so well debunked the sources of these kinds of numbers. We cannot take them at face value, and I'll comment in more detail over drinks.
Well, I think that Rachel Brand answered that correctly when she said that, and she's been in government like I have, and there are a good many of very good people in government. And in fact, when I taught down at the Federal Executive Institute, I was especially impressed by those people who came from the military and from the intelligence communities, unlike the Labor Department or HHS.
All right, let's get to our questions, and these are to be questions and not statements. All right, over here.
Can you hear me?
I think they're going to turn on your mic.
Can't hear it.
You can't hear me?
There we go.
Okay. My name is Dawn Kennedy. I'm with Concord, and thank you both for a great panel. My question is, you talked about journalists, you talked about government employees, and you know there's different statuses and different regulations that apply. I only heard Private Manning's name brought up in one context, but I have to ask what your thoughts are when we're talking about criminal prosecution of leakers. You know, somebody who's subject to, let's say, the UCMJ, who has voluntarily signed up, or somebody like Snowden who is under contract, or somebody who is a journalist who's leaking something from a third party. Can you please give us your perspective on the status and whether or not that bears anything on prosecutorial discretion?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And that's why in my opening remarks I drew a big distinction between, or I tried to, between government employees who presumably are subject to those kinds of obligations and journalists, and why it's especially troubling that the Obama administration is saber-rattling against journalists as well. But as journalists have said, that if their sources are subject to criminal prosecution, it obstructs their ability to do their job as well.
Okay.
All right, over here.
Hello, thank you.
You're on.
Paul Barrera from Seattle University School of Law. My question is for Professor Strassen. I was wondering how you define media, because you're talking about a media exception, and all of the sources that you guys quote are like the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and big box traditional newspapers, which in the 1917 Act would clearly be what was around. But now with like blogs and everything, where's the line where someone becomes a journalist who deserves the exception that you're promoting?
As somebody well put it in something I read recently, I think I don't even remember using the word media, but that what is relevant is not an institution, but a function. So anyone who serves the function of disclosing information to the public or to Congress, for example, should be treated differently than somebody who is disclosing information to a hostile foreign government. So it could be you writing a blog, it could be the Cato Institute publication, an ACLU policy report, and so forth, not at all limited to the establishment press.
Over here.
My name is Peter Donahue from George Mason University, and I just had a twofold question. Given that there seems to be a general consensus that Snowden or Manning did something wrong, what should they have done, given that they saw abuses? And the second part of my question is whether we should change our system to encourage them to go through the proper channels.
What should have been done with respect to what? After, you mean after the fact?
What should they have done in the first place if they saw an abuse to, in terms of revealing it?
You go up the chain of command. I mean, for better or for worse, government has an org chart. Every organization within government, you report to your immediate supervisor and so forth. It may be that you cannot get very far. That's possible. It may be that there is corruption at every level. In that case, you're advised to resign. That's what the honorable thing to do is. And that may mean that the corruption will have to come out in some other way, as it often does. But the thing that most troubles me about the Snowden, Manning, and other things is that you've got this very low-level person who presumes to know, or to make a moral judgment, when he may not even have a clue about the role he's serving in the larger context of things. And I mean, whether you're in a private organization or a public organization, or these things come to play. Now, the second part of your question was
Whether we should do anything to change our system to encourage the Snowdens.
Yeah, we should reduce the amount, as Nadine said, reduce the amount that is classified, and perhaps have training sessions to sensitize people to these kinds of things. But you're not going to get rid of it. I mean, it's just in the nature of the beast, and so that is the great dilemma. People are people.
All right, let's. I think we can squeeze in the three more questions if we move quickly, so we'll come over here.
Steve Krumen, Duquesne University. I'd like to focus on the second half of the question we've got tonight about the punishment. Mm-hmm. I think there have been a couple of hints, but I would like to know where each of you in the panel would stand on what I would propose as a fifth category to Ben's list, which would be the reasonable person standard. It seemed tonight like we talked about these whistleblowers, these people calling them whistleblowers as heroes. But often, they are really reasonable people who know that the information they're releasing would result in the loss of life of many people who are contained in some of these documents in the international affairs of the government. How do you feel about punishment when the person would reasonably be aware of that information before they released it to the media?
I think that's for you.
You're only looking at one side of the equation, though. So I think the determination for a court or any adjudicated body should be whether the risk to any national security or individual safety is outweighed by the benefit to the public. But from the perspective of the whistleblower, leaker, choose your term, the question should be whether that person believed in good faith and had a substantial basis for that belief that the benefit outweighed the harm.
You're going to ask judges to make a cost-benefit analysis over a matter concerning which they have no expertise. I would ask the judges in this audience if they feel comfortable making those kinds of determinations. I'll bet they don't.
I charge double for advisory opinions.
My name is Deborah Garrett. I'm from Thomas Good Jones School of Law. And my question for both of the panelists was, so much of the debate about national security and the NSA surveillance focuses on the consequentialism of the actions and does the benefit outweigh the invasion of the privacy, but shouldn't the discussion weigh more on the initial taking and the morality and ethics of the government's taking? And then my second part of my question was about, should we wait, even if we agree with some of the earlier panelists, about whether how far the abuses have gone? From the recent, we found out about the IRS and other government agencies on individuals in the country and targeting groups and political groups. Should we wait for the abuses to occur or see the process as abuse and do something about it then?
I didn't understand.
That's
the
second question.
I didn't understand the question quite. I'm sorry, I could not understand the question.
Okay. The first question was just about the consequentialism of the debate and how it focuses so much on, does the harm against the individuals outweigh mm-hmm. the actions that the mm-hmm. government's taking? And instead, should it focus in on the initial invasion and not what the outcome is for the government and the protection of citizens? Mm-hmm.
If you're asking me consequentialism versus deontological, I think that there's something wrong with the leaking per se, given the oath of office. Is that, does that go to your question? I'm having a hard time hearing it.
I'm basically asking about the fact that the debate within the national security, the government will always say, well, we're doing it for this good for the citizens, in the sense
we're doing it for what?
We're doing it for the good of the citizens, in the sense to protect national security, but shouldn't we focus on the initial invasion of individual liberty? So what the government did at the initial first stage with the information, and not what the outcome is for broader security or
Are you talking about the initial invasion of privacy under
right.
the NSA?
The ethics of that at the initial point. Shouldn't that be the focus of the debate and not what the national security outcome is?
Well, Congress has approved that, as I said earlier, and no final court has ever found it unconstitutional. So that, as a matter of law, decides the matter.
I disagree with that.
Well, on what
and
ground?
And maybe in this context, you're talking about the initial violation of First Amendment principles that occurs with excessive government secrecy. I think that's important because, you know, Roger, if you're saying judges cannot engage in balancing here, I guess you were just advocating an absolute position, which is odd in light of the fact that you acknowledge that these are gray matters, not black and white matters.
The balancing was done by the political branches. The
I'd
judges
say the
are there to afford
the
to
framers,
apply the law.
Right? The balancing was done by
the court is not a third legislative branch to reach a balance different than that was reached by the political branches.
Worse yet,
this is a cardinal principle of the Federalist Society, is it not?
Worse yet, that the executive branch is making these determinations, denying information to we the people, and even to our elected representatives, not to mention not allowing these issues to be aired before a genuine, independent Article III court.
Well, that's why we elect the president to do just that kind of thing. I mean, it's his job to make those kinds of decisions.
All right, let's go ahead with our final question because we're running out of time here.
My name is Nick Chidiak. When George Washington, Dr.
And you are from?
Dr. Pilon's alma mater, George Washington.
Okay.
When we hosted a debate on the disclosed NSA programs, Professor Steven Trachtenberg of American University indicated that he completely absolved the president of culpability and responsibility for these programs because he believed that the president should push as far as the structure will allow and believe that structure should govern these programs. So I have a two-part question. One, what can we achieve through structure, acknowledging that there
Second, repeat that.
What can we achieve?
So first off, what can we achieve through structure in terms of being able to have whistleblower programs that we're satisfied with being able to protect critical American secrets, protecting national security, and guarding against abuses? And so first, what can we achieve through structure? And second, have we made a mistake when an alleged civil libertarian can so completely absolve the chief executive for his actions on these programs?
I didn't hear your...
Is the person you're quoting is a libertarian, the professor that you're quoting?
He's a liberal professor at American University.
Well, I am willing to accept his premise for sake of argument that the first responsibility of the executive branch is to protect national security, and so that he or she, as president, is going to push those powers to the maximum. If, I will accept that, if, but only if, we have the other two branches of government that are being equally vigorous in exercising their checking and balancing functions. And we have not had that. Congress on both sides of the aisle has rolled over and played dead, except when it's politically expedient not to do so. And even the Article III courts have engaged in the opposite of judicial activism, using justiciability doctrines, the concept of secrecy in order to deny substantive review on the merits to virtually every challenge to every abuse of executive power. So we really need to shore up meaningful judicial review and meaningful congressional oversight. I've looked at the 48 recommendations that were made by the review board that President Obama appointed, and they make many structural recommendations along those lines, including an independent agency to receive national security whistleblower complaints, including making the FISA court much more transparent, having an independent advocate before it so it's no longer functioning ex parte, beefing up the oversight function of the intelligence committees.
One of the reasons the FISA court does not be more public is because we're dealing with terribly sensitive materials here. With respect to turning it over to another independent board to check it, why are we to suppose that that board will do any different than every other, than the FISA court itself does? The FISA court approves most of the warrant requests, almost all of the warrant requests that are brought to them, because they are very well scrubbed, and the function that the court serves is to discourage the executive branch from bringing requests that are not well scrubbed. Indeed, one of the complaints about 9/11 was that the Justice Department felt that it didn't have quite enough to get past the FISA court with the information that it had before them, and so they did not bring that. There is a lot of literature on just that narrow point. But again,
with that, we need to cut it off because we're over time. Let's thank our two debaters for a fantastic discussion.
You're a good.